From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection today was made 9 days ago now in Ferguson, Missouri. An 18-year-old black man named Michael Brown was shot and killed by a Ferguson police officer. Brown was shot, we now know, at least 6 times. The 28-year-old officer who shot him, Darren Wilson, is white. Brown was unarmed and had no criminal record. And although police say Brown was a suspect in a robbery that happened minutes before the shooting, police also say that Officer Wilson had no knowledge of that. Well, we've seen what's happened in the 9 days since, and it continues to unfold there in the St. Louis suburbs. And these 2 hours today, we want to talk about what we're learning in Ferguson, what we hope to learn going forward, and how we hope that we won't see something like that in Western New York. We've got a number of people, leaders in local initiatives and folks who can help explain some of what may be happening in Ferguson, but also some of what they've experienced in other parts of our world, including Rochester and the surrounding areas here. In studio right now, we've got Bill Clark, the president of the Urban League of Rochester. Bill, nice to see you.
Good to see you also.
Kit Miller is here, the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Kit, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Vertus Robinson is here, an instructor of history and African American studies at Monroe Community College. Vertus, nice to see you.
Nice to see you. And good afternoon.
And in just moments, Bill Johnson, former Rochester mayor, is going to be bursting into the studio and sitting down to join us. And we appreciate Bill's time. We're going to be joined by a different panel in our second hour and would like to hear from you. But before we even really dig into some of the individual issues here, Bill Clark and I were talking about just before the hour started that, you know, Bill, it's sad to see the National Guard called in last night and so many references to a war zone. I understand there's looting going on and no one is sort of condoning that, but it also, I think the media's got to be careful not to overfixate on looting, which is such a small percentage of the people who are involved in those demonstrations, I should say.
I agree. And as you indicated, it's a very small number. And what we've learned from Ferguson is how not to handle a crisis situation. Because, number one, it took the administration 6 days to release the name of the officer. And even following that, the governor was slow to react. It took the attorney general. It took the president of the United States phone call to the governor in order to get the process moving along. But most importantly, on Friday, when the police chief, I think it was Friday when he released the name of the officer, the way he did it, the way in which he did it was absolutely terrible. Because he did it in a way that he painted Michael Brown as a criminal and by releasing the tape and the video, and he also praised his officer for 6 years of outstanding service. The administration said they were not going to try this in the media, and he turned around and he did exactly that.
I think that's well said. And, you know, in a sense, with the officer Wilson, we're going to have to hear out his story and try to examine everything that led up to that shooting and try to step back and at least understand it. I don't think it's fair to anybody to withhold that name for that long, not even the officer. Put it out there and let's discuss it. Let's talk about what happened and let's try to learn and let's try to bring some justice as best we can going forward. So I couldn't agree more. And didn't you also think, Bill, that last week, as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, there were police who looked like they were going to war with what they were wearing and what they were driving. And all of a sudden, I don't know if it was Wednesday, it might have been Wednesday night, they stopped wearing that stuff. They went back to regular police uniforms. They didn't drive around looking like they thought they were in some sort of an actual war zone. And for at least a brief moment, there were pauses. There were dialogues in the street. It wasn't as tense. Doesn't that tell us a lot?
It really does, especially the fact that they brought in a state police captain and the governor did finally acquiesce and put it in the state's hand. But when they brought in the police captain who was from the community, who was able to relate to the community, talk to the leadership, talk to the citizens, and it was a completely different atmosphere at that point in time.
Yeah, and so Kit Miller with the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Again, we talk about violence or nonviolence. It feels, I don't want to spend 2 hours today indicting the police in this case. I do think it's fair to examine their actions. And if you're looking at violence or nonviolence, you sort of dress for the occasion, and police officers have been dressing for several days as if they expected some sort of armed resistance, as opposed to trying to maintain order, have a dialogue with the community. I mean, am I wrong to think of it that way?
I think that the increasing militarization of police in this country is well documented. There's a nice piece that Glenn Greenwald just wrote in the last couple of days, and he cites a whole bunch of both books and articles that talking about how, especially since the war on drugs, you know, and even back to those days, but certainly after 9/11, there was an acceleration of thinking of the police as a place that where military gear that was no longer needed could be put over, you know, into domestic use. So I think there's a major issue with the militarization of police, and of course that how that disproportionately affects, you know, people of color and people who are living in communities with less political sway. I mean, one of the things that I think it's important for us to have integrity in terms of what we say, and even like issues around like something that I speak a lot about is the unfairness of which schools in this community, for instance, have metal detectors. And we actually haven't, maybe I've even said this before in the show to you, but we actually haven't had a mass shooting yet in one of our urban schools. But it was after the shooting in Columbine that there was a pretext. It was used as a pretext to put metal detectors in our urban buildings. But we talk so much about research and the use of research, but if we were being research-based, then we would have metal detectors in schools in Penfield and Brighton and schools
in
like that.
Schools.
So the whole issue, like for me, there's the militarization issue, and then there's really, you know, don't just apply research where it's politically convenient to do so.
Let's look at some numbers here in terms of data. This comes from 2013 data. Look at this. Look at Ferguson as a municipality. The black population of Ferguson is 63%, but 86% of people stopped by police in Ferguson are black. 92% of people searched by police in Ferguson are black. 93% of people arrested in Ferguson are black. There are now 50,000 SWAT raids in this country annually. 50,000 SWAT raids. 1,000 SWAT raids per year in the average state. And obviously it's not a perfect breakdown, but that is a remarkable number. And again, I'm not condemning all of them, but I'm saying let's look at some of these things. And Virtus Robinson, who is a professor of history, you had the mayor of Ferguson on national television last week saying, you know, I do want to say that Ferguson has never had a problem of race. I've never seen it. I mean, he's either lying or ignorant to the point of disbelief, isn't he?
Yes. I believe that he is buying into his own myth. And this really brings back something that I teach, and that is, Dr. King's letter to the Birmingham Jail. I mean, from the Birmingham Jail, in which he talks about direct action, but using nonviolent tactics. But he said that it's necessary to create a tension in the mind so that individuals, and I'm quoting from him, could rise from the bondage of myths and half-truths to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal. And then he goes on to say that we must see the need of having nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in the society that will help men to rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. I think this is what's going on here. This direct action, and not all of it's violent, if you want to call looting violent. Not all of it is violent. There are peaceful protests going on. There are prayer groups. There are sit-ins. People are
peaceful. Well, the vast majority.
The vast majority. Yeah, and in fact, some people are standing in front of stores. I mean, some young black men and women are standing in front of stores protecting some of these stores. So what we're seeing in the media is the violent or the looting, but not all the peaceful protests that is going on. That is this direct action that is showing the tension and letting the world know what's going on. And what's going on, really, what is really going on in all of our neck of the woods.
I just don't think it does anybody any good to hear a political leader say, boy, until this happened, we just had no racial problems at all. And that's not to say that he didn't believe that things were better than they were. That's okay, I think, to say that. I mean, especially for white people. You know how easy it is for me to think there's no racial problems in the world? I mean, my goodness, it couldn't be easier for a white middle-class American male like me to think everything's fine. especially if I've never been on the receiving end of discrimination, and I don't think I have. But at this point, I think you have to look. Now you have to look at what did precede everything in Ferguson. What is the history? Look at those arrest rates. Look at those stop and search rates. What does that tell us about? Look at the incarceration rates. What does that tell us about inequality? What does that tell us about the way inequality is exacerbated? We talked about this on the program a little bit last week. We also talked last week to a former state senator from St. Louis, Missouri, named Jeff Smith, about, coincidentally, an entirely different issue. And if you heard Jeff on the program last week, you might be interested to hear that as a native St. Louisan, he was asked about what can be done now to help. And Jeff wrote, and this went viral online, he said, it's going to sound strange for me to say it, but it's about time for white people to get out there and join the protests or the demonstrations en masse. Mm-hmm. It cannot be a black versus white, black versus police issue. And to that end, Kit Miller shared an article with me this morning that I'm seeing everywhere online today. This is from a former attorney and a writer named Janae Woods. She wrote a piece about why the white community needs to get involved more here. Here's a part of her piece that is getting a lot of attention. Quote, a lot of white people aren't speaking out publicly against the killing of Michael Brown because they don't see a space for themselves to engage meaningfully in the conversation so that they can move to action against racism. It's not so much that they have nothing to say, but rather they don't see an opportunity being opened up for them to say something or to do something that matters. Or they might not be sure what to say or how to do it. They might have a hard time seeing a role for themselves in the fight against racism because they aren't racist. They don't feel that racism affects them or their loved ones personally. They worry that talking about race and differences between cultures might make things worse, or they think they rarely see overt racism at play in their everyday lives. And sometimes they are afraid. There's a real fear of saying the wrong thing, even if the intention is pure, of being alienated socially and economically from other white people for standing in solidarity with black people, or of putting oneself in harm's way, whether the harm be physical or psychological. I'm not saying those aren't valid fears, but I am challenging white people to consider carefully whether failing to speak out or act because of those fears is justified when white silence and inaction mean the oppression and potentially the death of black people. She then lists 12 steps to becoming a white ally to black people. And before we even get to that, Virtus, what do you think when you hear that?
Bravo. Absolutely bravo. That's that privilege, you know, that is there, that we are hearing more about. It's always been there since the beginning of this country. I mean, going all the way to the 1600s, it was there. And this is an ongoing problem, and if it could be solved tomorrow, it would be. But my goodness, I mean, we live in a society that is so capitalist society, is money driven, is power driven, and who owns that power is what really drives all of this. I mean, and that power means access. To wealth, access to employment, access to land, jobs, all of that. And unfortunately, the power rests in the white male Anglo-Saxon Protestant. That's where it lies. And it's not going to be an easy, or I don't know if even in my lifetime if that's going to change, no matter if we have a black president or not. So especially when we elected a first black president, a lot of people were saying that now we live in a colorblind society. I hear all the time, oh, I don't see color. How can you not see it? It's been with us from the beginning, and from the day we're born to the day we die, color is there. And so if we go and say that this is not a race issue, I'm sorry, but it is. I've seen that in news ads and saying, oh, some people, oh, this is not a race issue, it's a human issue. Yes, it is, but that race is there. I'm sorry, but we do not live in a colorblind society. And things like this, unfortunately, I don't like all the looting, and I don't like, you know, the shirts off with the pants sagging and the handkerchiefs over and all these images that we're seeing of young black males not looking like young black males. I'm sorry. how media has stereotyped young black males, that's what I'm seeing on the media right now. I'm not seeing people holding hands. And also, there are white protesters. There are in the peaceful, nonviolent demonstrations that are going on. And so, bravo to that article.
There is a great image right now making the rounds. You'll find it on Twitter, of a black man standing next to a white man in Ferguson, and they have signs with arrows pointing at each other, and the white man is holding a sign that says, is my life worth more than his life, with an arrow pointing at him, and the black man has a sign that says, is my life worth less than his life? And, you know, Bill Clark, you know, I want to hear from you on this, because I was moved by that piece by Jhené Woods, and I know Virtus obviously was too. What do you think?
Absolutely, and I will say again that, you know, my heart goes out to the family, because basically the family at this point in time, they just want the truth. And the truth has been delayed, and it's also been disguised. And that was unfair to that to Michael Brown's family. But I also wanted to indicate that even though this is an awful tragedy, there's also some things that are happening now in Ferguson. For example, there's active voter registration campaigns. I know the St. Louis Urban League is working with the United Way to make sure that food is distributed to families that need it in Ferguson. I also know that they're working with the Business Association to make sure that the one business gets rebuilt, and also that other businesses are protected, so that, because as you've indicated, 63% of the individuals that live there are African Americans, and the citizens of Ferguson understands they need to protect their businesses and their resources. So a lot of good is going on, and I think Captain Ron Johnson said best when he said that they will all be better as a result of this tragedy, and I think we need to continue. The citizens of Ferguson need to continue the positive outpouring that they're doing. And they need to make sure that they make changes in that community, because as you indicated, you talked about only 3 of the 53 police officers in that community being black, but you also have 6 council members. 5 of the 6 are white. You have a white mayor, a white police chief. Not to say that's wrong, but we need to get full diversity in that community, because once you build diversity, then the confidence of the people will increase also, and they'll feel better that they can get a fair shake when it comes to police intervention.
Yeah. Kip Miller, this morning I saw that Jhené Woods piece online in a lot of places, and yet you also felt compelled to share it with me to make sure I saw it. Mm-hmm. Why?
For me, there's 2 major issues, you know, and I appreciate, Bill, you saying about the family, because am I thinking so much about this family losing a child?
Yes.
But I imagine all the other families in this country who have lost their children in the same way. So many families have lost their young men in the same way. And even the man, you know, who was killed last month on Rhode Island, who was trying to intervene between a fight and was suffocated by the police. You know, like, there's just such a pattern when you start to watch it, you know. So I almost feel like for every one of those families having this happen again, like Trayvon Martin's parents having this happen again, it's just like, it's just pain again and again and again, because it's the same injustice. So so for me, I think there's 2 things that I'm interested in, because my focus is so on Rochester, you know. And one is to be thoughtful about, how can we roll back the militarism in our own local police? And I actually had the blessing of having a good conversation with one of the local suburban chiefs. And he just said, you know, it's so hard to resist it. You know, there's a tremendous amount of pressure. So I think we really need to look at some citizen action around saying, you know what, all the research points to the idea that actually community policing works the best everywhere. In the city and in the suburbs. And we need to just say, no, thank you. We don't want all that technology here. We want to do something different. You know, we want to have a community policing purpose or focus, and we want to make sure that the systems that are used to look at police issues in this community are trusted, so that when things happen, that the community trusts the policies and the procedures that are in place, so we don't need to, you know, lose it when stuff like that happens. So the issue of police and trusting and enforcement and militarism, I think, are important issues for us. And then the second is, and the reason I shared this article, is about racism. for me, more and more, you know, in the work of nonviolence, and I actually just posted this on the Gandhi Institute Facebook page today, in this country especially, if you're interested in nonviolence, you're interested in peace, you've got to be working on anti-racism work. You have to be. They're the same work. You can't be someone who talks about Dr. King and admire him and not be working on that. I'm glad, you know, for the Facing Race, Embracing Equity work that's being done in the community here, and I'm glad for the Library Race Dialogues project that I've been involved with in the last few years, and very grateful to the libraries for hosting those. I want to put in a plug. We've been doing those libraries and those dialogues in urban and suburban mm-hmm. settings. We've had almost 1,000 Monroe County residents come through. For white people especially who, like, think that have such a hard time speaking about race in cross-racial settings, it's so important that you come to one of those or that you create an opportunity. They're free. All you have to do, you can get a hold of me. You can get a hold of Rebecca Foose at the Friends of the Rochester Public Library and set it up. It's just a phone call. So I think it's important that people in this community take those issues seriously. We need to think about the militarism of our police, and we need to really get active if we're not already active on anti-racism work.
And Evan, I'd just like to add that the whole basis of the Urban League movement, when we were founded in 1910, we were founded on the basis of blacks and whites working together to eliminate poverty and to improve opportunities for African Americans. We have always been a diverse organization. We have always been a very inclusive organization, and we feel that that is the most effective way to address issues of racism and the like. And so when you asked earlier what did I feel about the sign, I think that that sign actually symbolizes what the Urban League stands for.
Yeah. I hope that we see more of a diverse, peaceful protestations happening, and I think we are seeing that. I do want to get to the phones, and I want to let you know as well that Kit Miller has talked about police and police work. We're going to be talking more about that in this coming half hour and then in next hour as well. You can weigh on any of these threads if you want to. Let's grab our first phone call. Comes from Ken in Pittsford. Ken, thanks for calling Connections.
Hey, Evan. I'll be as quick as I can here. I think the police chief should be fired for many reasons, but the big one is he gave us no information. I mean, he's called press conferences, and there's no information about what happened that really the confrontation here. I mean, we're all kind of jumping to conclusions on what may have happened, but we really have no information, which is terrible. I think a lot of this could have been stopped if people just knew what had really happened. Now we're going to a third autopsy, and it's just getting out of control. But the other stat I heard last week was the crime, black-on-black crime, is all the murders in this country, 90% of them, I'm trying to get this right, 90% of African-Americans that are murdered in this country are at the hands of other African-Americans. And I rarely hear that talked about. I mean, something like this comes up, and obviously everyone's in an uproar, and, you know, we should be, maybe. Again, we don't have all the information on this, but it seems like even in the city of Rochester, this almost happens on a weekly basis.
Yeah, well, it's
just a day-to-day thing. You know, it just happens.
Let me just jump in real quick, because I want you to hang in there, because I want to suggest one thing, Tim, because I saw the same stat. I think that's almost a separate issue for a separate day, and it's probably related, but at the same time, I don't mean to be trite about this, but police are not supposed to be murdering anybody if this turns out to be a murder or an unjustified
killing. Well, we don't know any information.
Right. That's why I'm saying I don't know. If this turns out to be an unjustified killing, police are not supposed to be killing citizens, and most of the time when a citizen dies
You're
at
right.
the hands of police, it's a black person dying at the hands of a white officer. I'm not trying to incite anybody. I'm trying to look at facts, and I don't know if the panel will correct me on this, mm-hmm. but Tim, I understand your point, and there has to be improvements on all of those things. I think the reason we're looking at it this way right now is police are not supposed to be killing unarmed people, and usually when that happens, it's a black person dying from a white officer.
And yeah. also, just
you're right.
To add,
but the police chief is just—I mean, he's who knows if he will get fired. I mean, he has no control over the situation. I think a lot of the protests would obviously still be happening, but the amount of rage that's going on could be hopefully stopped a little, or you know, controlled a little bit if they just knew kind of what had really happened.
Yeah, Tim, I'm a transparency guy, and all this does is it makes things worse. I think it's a great point. I appreciate the call. Let's let Bill respond there. Go ahead, Bill.
I just wanted to indicate that there is a lot going on in the African-American community to stop black-on-black crime. There's rallies every week. There's not a Sunday that goes by that is not spoken from the pulpits of many of our churches. There's numerous organizations and the Urban League. I mean, we're working to eliminate. We realize that the number one killer of black youth are other black youth, and we're working hard through education programs. We're working hard to address this issue. But this is not a media issue. I mean, the media is not going to come out for this type of an issue. So things are being done. I just wanted to say that.
And let me speak a little extemporaneously, and I could get myself in trouble, but this will be a little bit of a kind of a little thought experiment here. Most black-on-black crime, most white-on-white crime in the youth or in the youth level, or really probably all ages, are people who are either impoverished, have dealt in other areas of crime for various reasons. Again, I know sometimes it's crime of passion, but a lot of the times it's people who probably don't have a great home structure, et cetera. You're not going to wipe out all black-on-black crime by improving inequality, reducing inequality, improving employment, improving education, but you're going to wipe out some of it. And part of the reason we have inequality, tension, racial problems, racial animus, et cetera, starts with – I don't want to say it starts with. An ingredient of that is a confrontational police force that – the citizens are not trusting of, that they feel are treating them poorly, that they are arrested and searched disproportionately, they are incarcerated disproportionately, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know if I'm making any sense here. Virtus, you're the professor of history, but I'm just trying to think out loud here and say, I think Tim makes an important point. We've got to reduce black-on-black violence. We have to reduce white-on-white violence, all kinds of violence. But I think looking at this, that's a little bit outside of the sphere of what we're looking
at. Right, because this is involving law enforcement I know that we don't know all the facts, but from what I gather and my assumptions and interpretation of this is that this man was stopped while crossing the street when the cops were in their car. And it's not true that we don't know everything, because we know one side of it. In other words, his friend that was there, that was just inches away from him when he was shot, came out and gave his story. And that's available. His story is available. Again, I know in the court of law, there's always two sides to a story. And in even in history, there's multiple sides to a story. But we do have one take on it. Now we need, and we do have the reports, which are available to the public, of what was said immediately after, a report of this. So we do have two sides that we can weigh in. But at the same time, this is not an issue of civilians here. This is civilian and enforcement.
Mm-hmm. I want to, if I may, make a quick comment about this whole issue of youth violence, too, because this is a big part of what we work on. You know, we've got nonviolence clubs in local high schools, both suburban and urban, and working with kids. And one of the reasons why we have that is because in this country, we're educated through the media to think of violence as both necessary and even pleasurable. Watch the summer blockbuster movies. I mean, we can't bring kids up on this media diet around like violence and that good guys hurt bad guys and that you cheer when someone gets killed. I mean, you can't judge kids for taking those messages in when they've seen them, you know, thousands of times through all kinds of television, through movies. So I want adults, you know, especially not to just shake their fingers at youth and say, well, why are they so violent? They were brought up on a diet that we allowed them to have through their screens.
Let's do this. I'm going to take the shortest break in radio. And if you're waiting on the phone, we're getting to you next. And we're going to continue the discussion. Our panel is going to be kind of changing over the 2 hours here, because we have so many people who are going to help us weigh in on what's going on in Ferguson, what we understand in our own community, lessons to learn, and things we can change going forward. Right now in studio we have Kit Miller, the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, Bill Clark, the president of the Urban League of Rochester, Virtus Robinson, an instructor of history and African-American studies at Monroe Community College. So if you're waiting on the phone, your next short break, and we're coming back with you on Connections.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us.
Here and Now this afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Eric Clark tells us about his new novel, Sweetness Number 9. In the 1970s, a flavor chemist works on an artificial sweetener that becomes a popular sugar substitute, but he worries it's causing obesity and other problems in the country and in his family. And Adam Rogers tells us how to avoid a hangover. His new book is Proof. Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. To the phone, Jenna from Pittsford. Thanks for calling, Jenna.
Hey, I just wanted to chime in. The quote that you read from Janae really resonated with me, because my family is extremely diverse, and I have three nephews and one niece who are all Black. They might not be African-American, but they are Black. And one of my nephews was involved in a racial incident at his high school where, you may remember it, Evan, it was a story from Waverly, New York, and down near Elmira, and the school had a blackface incident of reenacting the Rihanna Chris Brown domestic violence episode. My nephew is the only Black student in that high school. And the threats that he received via Facebook, social media, and email were just astounding. At the same time, he had been at my home, and we've had experiences, whether with him or at restaurants, where we've been asked if he's adopted or you're taking care of somebody. He's family. He's my nephew. So for me, racism is alive and well, but I always try to remember this quote, and forgive me, I'm not sure if it's Marianne Williamson or Maya Angelou, but what they said was, if you turn the lights on, darkness goes away. And I'm paraphrasing. But I think the issue with Ferguson is there hasn't been any transparency. There hasn't been any truth. If the police chief stood up and said, this is what happened, we're investigating it, it would be a completely different situation. We've had that experience in Rochester with Chief Shepard, with Bob Duffy, et cetera. They don't have that in Ferguson. And even in the Trayvon Martin case, which I know didn't involve law enforcement per se, there was no truth. There was no transparency. There was nobody coming out in front of it. They hid the body from his parents. That kind of thing, to me, that's what inflames and incites people's rage, because we expect more from our leaders, and we deserve more, all of us.
Jenna, great comments here. Kit, can you weigh in there?
I have friends who, you know, with similar issues with your nephew, children of color who are attending some of our suburban schools in the Rochester area who really struggle, you know, and they struggle not just from the kind of ignorance of some of their white peers in their school, but frankly from the ignorance of mainly white teachers and administrators in those same buildings.
Yes, ma'am.
So I think it's critical. I think it's critical for people who, you know, take care of the needs of young people in this community to get very serious about learning and this. And for me, you know, if you're a white person, anti-racism work is internal. You've got inside work to do. You've got interpersonal work to do. And you've got structural work to do. It's just like nonviolence itself. So I'm grateful for your call. Thank you.
I've got a comment here from George on Twitter, and I'm not going to waste a lot of time on it, but I want to air it because, again, we're seeing a lot of this sentiment. George says, nobody should be murdering innocent people. Police are forced to confront potentially dangerous people. You know, if that is the rationalization then there's no improvement of policing. And police are very well trained, by the way, to recognize threats. One of the things that's been pointed out this week is, have you seen those ridiculous pictures of the Ferguson police wearing camo, even though I don't see a whole lot of jungle in bushes and things like that? They're wearing camouflage on the streets of Ferguson, pointing military-style rifles at black people walking at them with hands up. You've probably seen the pictures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Now, military experts will tell you, people who've been in the military will tell you, the training is you only point when you're really ready to shoot, because a loaded gun pointed at somebody is that's an escalator. It often leads to shooting from one side or the other. And Ferguson police have been walking around just pointing at people as if that is common practice. Yeah. They are supposed to be trained. They're supposed to be trained not to do that. They're supposed to be trained to recognize threats. They're supposed to be trained to disarm people or to take down an unarmed person who might be violent. And again, we're going to learn more about what happened with Michael Brown. And this officer could have felled the man without killing him. Sometimes you could use a firearm to fell somebody without killing them, not shooting them six times, including in the head. So all I'm saying is, to George's point on Twitter, sorry, but just saying, hey, they've got to deal with potentially dangerous people, so let's just focus on blacks killing blacks, whites killing whites, whatever. That misses, I think, a lot of the point.
Yes.
Anybody want to jail? I'm ranting too much.
I'm sorry.
I'm having a migraine. I'm a little off today, folks. I'm sorry.
I agree with your comments 100%. Even the friend that was with him indicated that he thought the policeman was going to shoot him with a taser. Mm. You don't, because if they have all this military paraphernalia, don't they have tasers? So I agree with you 100% on your comments.
Yeah, and also I've heard, and again, allegedly, that Michael Brown had tried to reach for the officer's gun. And then the person next to him said that that's not what happened. Again, that is a common excuse. Oh, I'm fighting for my life and for my own defense. But I also read that on the first night of protests, when it was thought that a peaceful protest, a peaceful march, had started to escalate a little bit, then tear gas was thrown into the crowd.
Yeah.
Now, there was a question, whether it's tear gas or was it just regular gas? It was gas. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But that is going to create panic, and immediately it's a confrontation, it's aggression on one side.
Isn't it also a violation of people's constitutional right for peaceful assembly?
Peaceful assembly. Mm-hmm. But then the excuse is, it's not peaceful any longer.
All right, I'm going to get back to the phones in just a second. I want to read a comment that I've received from a police officer I know well, who's not local. He's a police officer in another state. He's been in multiple departments. And so he and I had a bit of a dialogue, and I asked him for his thoughts about whether police owning military-style gear gives them almost an impetus to use it, whether or not they need to. And I want to read his response. This comes from a police officer. He says, yes, it very much does. The very first call we went on after we got ARs was a standard suspected kidnapping. One of the guys I was with slung his new rifle. Prior to that, we never would have even considered drawing weapons. That's just the example that jumps to mind. I've seen tac vests on everyday patrol and other stuff like that. I'll be honest, it looks cool, and everyone wants to look cool. It does change the way people react to you, though, so I avoid it. Do we need it? It's a tough call. That rifle has given me a great deal of comfort in situations before where I was either outgunned or vastly outnumbered. That's just the tip of the military iceberg, though. That and a vest are all the average cop needs. I don't see the need for the incredible amount of stuff Ferguson apparently owns. People will escalate to the levels the police seem capable of handling. I honestly don't believe even mobs want to kill a cop. Put that cop in a helmet and a tank, though, and you've added the illusion that they are there to dominate you, and by extension, kill. The crowd will rise to that. If you need that level of naked aggression, you have failed repeatedly along the line, and it's time to call in a special unit. It should be noted that's just my opinion. Again, that's someone I know well who is a police officer in another state talking about what happens when police go out and ride in what looks like a tank. Let's get back to the phones. This is Maggie from Rochester. Maggie, thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to make a couple observations. Most of the terrible school shootings that have happened in the past have been in rural or suburban schools, and yet the city kids are the ones who are paying, having to go through these metal detector things every day before they go into school. Another, and I think that is just prejudice and just what you're saying. The other thing I wanted to pick up on was the statistic about the city council out there in Ferguson. 5 out of 6 people on the council are white. The mayor is white. And it just made me wonder, are the black people not running? Are they not voting? I'd like to dig down and get more information about that statistic. And finally, I'd like to say about the police, the way the policing has been going in this country for the last 20 years or so, the zero tolerance, it just fosters this kind of aggressive, overly aggressive behavior. Some people are not psychologically prepared to be police. Sometimes police have to take guff from people, or they get sassed back or something. And if they take it personally and they overreact, you have to screen and give them good training. And I'm not sure how much of this is being done anymore, especially with this zero tolerance. Thank you.
Yes. I read an article this morning in one of the Boston newspapers, and basically what it indicated is one of the things, good things that have come out of this tragic incident is the fact that there are active voter registration booths that are being set up right in Ferguson, and it has really motivated a lot of the citizens to register and to vote and to cast their disappointment, because as I indicated earlier, I mean, there was inaction by the police chief, there was inaction by the mayor, and initially there was inaction by the governor. So the only way you're going to change this is through political power, and with 63% of the population being African American, the hope is that this voter registration campaign will be effective and people will begin to take back their city and put people in office that they feel they can trust, either white or black.
And before I know Kent wants to weigh in, let me just also say, Bill's comments there are occasionally interpreted by people of some political persuasions as saying, well, you know, black people will only vote for black people and all that. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that we do have a big disparity in this country on who votes. And the black population votes a lot less, and the poor population votes a lot less, and registration is a big problem. And so that's not saying, hey, black people of Ferguson, get out there and elect some black people. That's saying, let's get more people active, voting, thinking about their community, thinking about their options. And what that likely does is it brings more of an accurate representation of a community's diversity to the elected levels there. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be all black or all white or all this or all that. It just means more people are involved. Is that fair, Bill?
Absolutely.
Okay. Vertus as well.
No, and if I live in a community in which I don't feel that my voice will ever be heard, or that my vote will go anywhere, or that there are I don't have any true representation, and this is something that is permeating my community, and I have no control over it, I'm going to throw my hands up in the air. And not at, you know, when a cop is, not just when a cop is, has his gun at me or says freeze, because a lot of that will go on too. But I'm just going to say, well, if I cannot vote, if I cannot be a citizen, and it's not because of my own inaction, it's because of oppression that's going on in this community, then this will happen. What's going on in Ferguson?
Kit?
I just was so appreciating your friend's comment, the police officer. And one of the things I want to point out was how also this kind of police oppression affects our ability to have information. I'm referencing that Washington Post Wesley Lowry and Huffington Post Ryan Riley were both arrested and assaulted while working at a McDonald's, filing reports for the media. And I just want to say that quickly that Riley from the Huffington Post said he was arrested by a St. Louis County police officer in full riot gear who refused to identify himself despite my repeated requests, purposely banged my head against a window on the way out, and sarcastically apologized. He wrote, "I'm fine, but if this is the way these officers treat a white reporter working on a laptop who moved a little too slowly for their liking, I can't imagine how horribly they treat others." And then the other reporter, who's African-American, also tweeted his account. So I think it's really important for us to recognize that the oppression really has big big consequences for our ability, even as a nation, to have access to information to be able to make good choices.
We're going to get back to the phones in just a second. We had a question on Twitter about why police officers or police departments have military-style equipment to begin with. And I've got a soundbite I'd like to play with a man by the name of Radley Balko. Radley Balko is the author of the book Rise of the Warrior Cop. He now writes for the Washington Post, a libertarian writer who has been talking about police behavior for years. And he was on CNN this weekend talking about the question of where did this all begin with? So the question we got on Twitter can be answered by these comments from Radley Balko.
It began informally under the Reagan administration. It was then turned into a formal program by Congress in the 1990s. And the thinking was that we need to fight the drug war. It was really the drug war that motivated this. We need to fight the drug war as if it were a literal war. And so part of doing that was making this surplus military equipment available. And, you know, the equipment is bad. I think it's problematic not just because of you know, the gear itself, but also the mentality, I think, that it fosters in police officers. When you're dressed like a cop, or excuse me, when you're dressed like a soldier and trained like a soldier and armed like a soldier and trained in military tactics and told that you're fighting a war, whether it's a war on crime or a war on drugs or war on terror, at some point you're going to start to take that literally and start to assume the mindset of a soldier. And a soldier's mindset just isn't an appropriate, appropriate in domestic policing.
That's Radley Balko, the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, talking about where this all began with. And now you've got police departments, even rural police departments. Check out what John Oliver said on HBO this weekend, having a little, poking a little bit of fun at it, but being very serious about the fact that you have small police departments applying for essentially tanks. And in one place in New Hampshire, they applied because they were worried about terrorism hitting their pumpkin festival. That's a real, actual request, and they get a tank out of it. So, yeah, I think these questions are probably valid. We did invite Jim Shepard, former Rochester police chief, to join us on this program today. I was told this morning that he got the request, but he is not going to be available to talk about that. And I understand it can be difficult, but we're going to, you know, and we don't want to condemn all police officers either. You know, I mean, at times it probably sounds like it, but it's not. The police do tremendous work on a daily basis, and I don't think anybody on this panel disagrees with that. This is Maria in Rochester. Maria, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, there's a couple of things that I wanted to talk about that are a little bit more systemic than some of the conversation has been in terms of what we can do. And I've lived in Rochester since 1978, and there has always been a call for civilian review of police. I remember Alicia McCuller and Calvin Green. These were 30 years ago, and this stuff has gone on. And I'm sorry, but the community does not have faith that the police can clean its own house. And if there's not faith in that, then you can't expect that when there's an investigation, there's not going to be bias designed to protect the police rather than the citizens involved. I think we've seen this with the Benny War case recently. The other thing I think that's very important is having residency requirements for police officers. I'm pretty sure that most of the police officers in Rochester don't live in Rochester, and therefore the community is not their community. And I think then that leads into the whole militarization. If the people that you're policing are not your neighbors, it's far easier to see them as your enemies, especially if you've got riot gear and all of these new militaristic things that you're seeing that they're having. And the last thing I just want to say, for me, it's always interesting when I'm thinking about oppression and situations like this to do reversals and to think about how the community would react. And I would really ask people to be very honest about if it was a predominantly white community being policed by an almost entirely African-American police force, and this kind of activity happened, there would be a very different outcry and a very quicker response.
Thanks, Maria. Thanks for the call. On the issue of civilian review, next hour, we're going to talk a little bit more about dispute settlement and how to make sure we all feel good about any disputes that may come up with police. And we've got some people who are going to represent the Center for Dispute Settlement in Rochester. We can talk a little bit more about that. Anybody on the panel want to weigh in here on some of Maria's comments, civilian review and more? Bill?
I completely agree with the residency requirement. Mm-hmm. I know several years ago, many years ago, the Urban League took up that platform also, because at that point in time, the vast majority of police officers, fire officers, firemen lived outside of the city limits. And not only do the police not understand the community they're policing, but it's a tremendous loss of a tax base in the city also that takes us further down in poverty. So, I mean, I agree 100% with what I heard.
Okay, I want to let our listeners know, this is one of those rare days where we're devoting both hours of our program to this issue. We are going to have some other guests on in the next hour. If you're waiting on the phones, we are going to get back to you, and you can hang right there because we've got much more to come on this issue as we look at Ferguson, local impact, et cetera. And as we get ready to shift panels, I do want to thank the people who have taken their time this afternoon to share their thoughts with you. Virtus Robinson's an instructor of history and African American studies at Monroe Community College. Heard you on the phone before. It's nice to see you in studio.
Likewise.
come back another time, because we'll have plenty to discuss, as you can see.
Oh, I'll be delighted.
No, thank you for being here. Bill Clark, president of the Urban League of Rochester. Bill, it's always good to get your perspective. Thank you.
Thank you also.
Kit Miller, the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Kit, thank you.
Thanks, Evan, especially for putting both hours on this today. It means a lot.
All right, short break. Again, if you're waiting to comment, much more to come as we talk about Ferguson. Stay with us. From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we continue our discussion of the events in Ferguson, Missouri, and what we can learn here in Rochester, New York. What is our history? How do things compare? How can we make sure that our community isn't going to see the same kind of confrontation? We've got a new panel this hour, but we want your calls and comments, and we'll continue to have your calls either via the phone or on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. Here's our panel for the hour. We have Bill Johnson, not only a former Rochester mayor, but he is the owner of a consulting firm called Strategic Community Intervention. And this incident in Ferguson, Bill, I know you were down in Sanford, Florida, after what happened with Trayvon Martin. So you have some experience already in dealing with this.
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. We've got Frank Liberti and Sherry Walker-Cowart from the Center for Dispute Settlement. Sherry, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Frank, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And we've got a filmmaker, Shabaka Muassar, who is the filmmaker of Young Black Male, among others, and we're going to be talking about that in a moment. Shabaka, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right, so I want to start with Sherry. I just want to make sure our listeners know a quick definition of the mission of the Center for Dispute Settlement. Sherry.
Okay, well, the mission is to use and promote peaceful dispute resolution processes through our communities, and we serve 8 counties. But I want people to understand that we grew out of chaos. We grew out of the 60s and the social unrest of the 60s, and we've been around for over 40 years.
And so give me a kind of a thumbnail example of some of the disputes you might be there resolving.
You name it, we get in the middle of it, from neighbor disputes to child custody visitation to divorces to community unrest to the kinds of things that we're talking about today that people want to have a conversation about, that we involved in that.
And Frank, last hour we had a caller named Maria from Rochester say that she wants to see more civilian oversight of police nationwide. Yeah, I don't know how much that dovetails with what the center does, but she's saying there has to be somebody sort of outside of the department who can occasionally look at what's going on. What do you think?
That's exactly what we're empowered to do through city council legislation. As Sherry mentioned, we're really in the process of community building, and as an outcome of a high-profile police shooting back in the late 70s, our agency was called on to provide civilian oversight for law enforcement. And we've been doing that work since the late 70s. For 35 years, we've been involved in that. And we do provide that independent oversight. We're also an alternative complaint intake site for folks that want to register a complaint against a Rochester police officer.
Okay, so we're going to be talking more about that. Bill Johnson ran for mayor partially because of some of the things you had observed in this community. And Bill and I were talking during the break. I said I got here in late 2002, early 2003, and my recollection was there was at least one person who died at the hands of police. And, Bill, you jumped in and said there were four in 1 month in 2002.
That's right, in August of 2002. But as Frank indicated, this community was on tenterhooks back in 1975 when a young black woman, Denise Hawkins, was executed by Rochester police. And she was essentially a victim of domestic abuse and just happened to be caught up in a horrible set of circumstances, which led my predecessor, Mayor Ryan, to create a community task force. And out of that, a number of recommendations came for changing the training of police officers and the way police officers could execute their duties. But after Denise Hawkins died, at least 14 other blacks, including Alicia McCullough, who was the daughter of James McCullough, again, another victim of domestic abuse, was shot down by police officers. So I had been spending a lot of time in my role at the Urban League, trying to be a positive force, along with Andrew Thomas, who founded the Center for Dispute Settlement. And when I became mayor, this was important, that we actually changed the manner of policing, and that it led me to bring the first person from outside of the ranks of the Rochester Police Department, from outside of this community, to come in. Bob Warshaw was brought in. And we instituted a severe and very, very important regimen of community-oriented policing over the objections, the very vigorous objections, of the Police Locust Club, which represents patrol officers. But we were able to successfully do that. And even so, we still had black men who were being caught up in this showdown with the Rochester Police Department. So I can't sit here and say that during my 12 years in office, we completely solved that problem. But one of the things that I think we were very successful in was opening up the avenues of communication between average citizens and the police. We had programs like the NET program and NBN. And so when I am now watching what happened in Ferguson and when I watch what happened in Sanford, Florida, it was clearly that the police department was viewed as an occupation force. There was a tremendous amount of acrimony between the community and the police department. And it's very hard in the midst of crisis to start opening up the lines of dialogue. So long after the dust has settled in Ferguson, long after Michael Brown is buried, and long after all the protesters have gone away, and that community goes back to some kind of calm, there's a lot of work that has to be done, because that is a community that is greatly fractured. I've heard your last hour people comment on the fact that this is a white controlled town in a black, predominantly black area. Why isn't it that black people aren't voting in the elections? I mean, if they say they're oppressed, they have the means in America to get rid of their oppressors, and we've seen in two recent elections where that was not the case. So I just think that we see these things happen. And the question for us is, what can we do to prevent them from happening in other communities? And I think that what you're doing here today, Evan, I hope that these kind of dialogues are going on in all across this country, because everybody ought not to say it can't ever happen to us, because it has and it will continue.
Well, but here's where it didn't, Bill. In 2002 in August, four people died. That could have... That kind of situation, four people dying in a month in police hands, could explode. And one of the questions I asked you off the air was, how do you make sure, when you're the leader of a city, you support the police department, but you also support the community? You know, because at times, if you take the side of, for lack of better phrase, of somebody who, in this kind of dispute, police may feel like you're coming out against them. And if you side with police, and this way I look at Ferguson, it feels like the police chief immediately starts trying to tar Michael Brown. They want to release this video as if, hey, look at this. Well, he might be dead, but he was a criminal, and you know, you never know. And even though it was totally irrelevant because the officer who shot him apparently had no idea. That's different than the way you handled it. I see a lot of differences between the way Ferguson's handling it and the way you handled 2002.
Well, that was horrible what that police chief did, and he should have been fired on the spot. because first he didn't have the authority. Remember, the governor had placed the state police in control of the city of Ferguson, so that chief had no authority to go out and do what he did. He should be fired just for extremely poor judgment. And secondly, this is totally irrelevant. As he had to later admit, whatever actions Michael Brown may have engaged in prior to his killing had nothing to do with the confrontation he had with that police officer. So it was totally irrelevant. And so these are the kinds of things that I'm sure we're going to talk about that get a lot of people outraged. Here in the city, Mayor Duffy, which was very shocking to me, and he knows I publicly criticized him for this, instituted a program called Zero Tolerance. And he was the very man under whose leadership the police department really made great outreaches into the community. I thought it was horrendous that we should do that. But we
remind us about Zero Tolerance, what your objection was.
The fact that you were just stopping people indiscriminately for any kind of offense. You didn't have your light on your bicycle, and the police officer would pull you over and write you up. And that information would stay on file. And this was being done hundreds of times. And young black men were saying, What did I do? Why are you
harassing
me?
Because they get targeted really improportionate, aren't
not
they?
Not only improportionately, I mean, it would be hard for the Duffy administration to point to any white men who were being stopped for having no lights on the back of their bicycles. This is the problem that we find. I heard your callers, and there are people who are legitimately concerned about, well, why are you so upset? I want people to point out to me the last time they've heard that a white man was gunned down by a police officer.
An unarmed
white man was gunned down by a police officer for suspicion, okay? For suspicion. And this is the thing that eats at people's craw. I don't care how old or young you are, okay? Because I heard a man on television say last night, he said, every time I see a blue light come up behind me as I'm driving, I pray to God that that officer is going to pass me back because he's after someone else, because I cannot be certain what's going to happen if he pulls up behind me. And nobody should live in that kind of, people who are law-abiding citizens should not have to live in that kind of fear. And this is the kind of environment that exists in too many places. And Ferguson, Missouri, the last time I checked geographically, was in the northern part of the country. This is not Mississippi. This is not Alabama. This is not rural Georgia. We're talking about the suburbs of one of the largest metropolitan St. Louis is about 5 million people. We are not talking about some backwoods community here. And this is just unbelievable that in 2014 this kind of stuff could still be happening.
You were the mayor when there was more of a push in this country for military-style equipment in police departments. What do you make of this notion that when police show up wearing camouflage, holding military-style weapons, driving things that look like tanks, is that appropriate?
Well, I would tell you this. It was a shock to me because I don't ever recall receiving a tank or that kind of armament when I was mayor, even though right after after September 11, 2001, there was a lot of apprehension about all cities being subject to attack. And we went through all kinds of training exercises. But we didn't arm our police officers with this kind of armament. And to see these policemen looking like they are paratroopers headed into military conflict, pointing guns, and as you said in the last hour, loaded guns at their own citizens, is just absolutely beyond comprehension.
Yeah. So Bill talked about the Zero Tolerance program, and when we see those kind of programs, these are the kind of numbers. Here's 2013 data. If you missed it last hour, this is from Ferguson. Again, Ferguson, Missouri has a black population of 63%, but 86% of people stopped by police are black, 92% of people searched by police are black, 93% of people arrested in Ferguson are black. Chewbacca Mouassar is a filmmaker whose film, Young Black Male, I think the people in your film would see those stats and they'd be sadly unsurprised, Chewbacca. And you probably would be sadly unsurprised.
Yes. As a young black male who was raised in the city of Rochester, every black male I ever knew had some kind of police contact. It's almost like we can plan for to be searched, to be suspicious in any situation, whether it's night or day. And it's very disturbing to see the Michael Brown case, only because we've been through so much in this city and nationwide with the Trayvon Martin case, that I think the community is really fed up and people are want to do something about it. And this battle between the community and police have been going on for many, many years. And it seems to never go anywhere. And so are we going to be civilized enough as a community to do something about it and really try to bring the community together in this regards?
You might have seen Chewbacca talking about his film on my colleague Helen B. and Duty Hofer's program, Need to Know. For those who haven't heard of the film, Young Black Male, what's the mission? What's the story?
The mission is to first of all, bring awareness. We had the opportunity to give young black men in our community HD video cameras to go out and document some of those issues that they are faced with, whether it's education and police brutality, and really give them a voice, because a sound bite from Channel 10 is just not enough to describe the total impact of our youth in the community. So I empowered them by giving them video skills and trained them how to go out and shoot. And it resulted in a 3-year process that ended up with a screening of the film in May at the Little Theater. And we went, and that screening sold out, and we had the mayor there and different people from city council. We showed it again at the cinema, another sold out screening. We just had another screening at the Gandhi House on Wednesday, which was jam packed. And I think everywhere this film goes, people are pouring into place to be involved with the movement. We want to educate people, bring awareness, and think about solutions. How can we bring various different sectors of the community together to save our young black males who, based on the media, are under attack and are getting murdered by police?
All right. Now, we're going to go back to the phones in a second. Chewbacca sent young black males out with cameras, and they were capturing and telling these stories. Writing in Slate, Raihan Salam writes that every single law enforcement officer should be required to wear body-worn cameras, or BWCs, and every single law enforcement agency should adopt a protocol for the operation of these cameras that strictly regulates when the cameras can be turned off by the officers. Bystanders with cameras have changed policing forever. Witness the public outrage after the release of videos that depicted the beating of Marlene Pinnock and the chokehold death of Eric Garner. Police officers should have to wear cameras. Bill Johnson, what do you think?
Yeah, but I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. But technology now has armed almost all of us. Everybody walks around with a smartphone. And what police need to really understand is that they can no longer try to get away with these things, because in the distant past, when this technology was not available, it always came down to the word of the police officer against the word of the accused. And there was no documentary evidence that could overcome the word of the officer. Now, these situations arise, crowds come and gather. The police have no way of knowing who in that crowd has taken out their phone and pointed the lens and recorded the action. And that information is being shared either online or being made available in the case of when investigations occur. So it is absolutely important. What we got to understand is this. We need the police. We need security. And many of our poor communities are in need of security more than others. But there's got to be a trust here. This is like going to the grocery store. We need to eat. Who would go to a store where they consistently sold bad and tainted food? Okay? So I got food. I got chicken. All right? But it's bad. It makes me sick. We cannot afford police enforcement that's out of control. They are sworn, they take a oath to uphold the law, to enforce the law. And there are few people who go beyond that out of fear, because they are poorly trained, or because they shouldn't be on the police department in the first place because of prejudicial attitudes that they bring. So I think what Chewbacca is doing and what others are doing merely points out now a new landscape for law enforcement officers. That there is surveillance, video surveillance everywhere. There are cameras attached to buildings. There are cameras in the hands of average citizens. And there are people walking around who are trained by people like this, who know what they're doing when they're holding a camera, who make certain that they are getting it down perfect. And that means that police departments now should not be trying to figure out how do they get around that kind of surveillance, but how do they essentially perform their duties in such a way that avoid leading to the kind of dangerous, fatal results that we have seen in Long Island the other day and in Ferguson, Missouri, and this in so many places. Let me tell you, it's highly unlikely that the incident in Ferguson would have achieved national recognition. Because I'll tell you, I travel a lot. I pick up newspapers everywhere I go, and I'm on the line. I'm on the internet reading papers every day. There are these kind of incidents that happen in a lot of communities that never get national attention. This is not isolated. This is a pattern that we're seeing with police work. And so I think that the average citizen who sits back and say, what is this fuss all about? You know, why are these black people making all this noise? They need to ask themselves two questions. Why is it happening so frequently? And two, and this is a terrible question to ask, why is it not happening to my son? See, there are many white boys who have to ride the streets fearful of when they see a police car coming up behind them, that they're going to get into a violent and a fatal encounter with the police department. And most black men, even people like me, I've been stopped by the police. And then when they found out I was the mayor, they asked me, okay, on your way. Well, there aren't many black men who have that kind of privilege. And I look at it and I don't say, thank you. I'm saying, why except me? Why did you stop me in the first place? I wouldn't do anything wrong. Why did you stop me in the first place?
You're hearing from Bill Johnson, former Rochester mayor. Bill is now the owner of a consulting firm called Strategic Community Intervention that works on exactly these kind of problems and has worked in these kind of problems around the country. Shabaka Muasar is a filmmaker of Young Black Male. Sherry Walker Coart and Frank Liberty are here from the Center for Dispute Settlement. Before I get to again to the phones, briefly, I want to ask Sherry and Frank, in general, what would you tell the community? And again, I don't want to have the premise here that a powder keg's about to happen here, even though one of our callers wants to ask or make the point that it could happen here if we're not careful. Sherry, I'll start with you. You have a basic dispute, and people want to feel like that there is an outlet that is fair, that not that the cards are going to be stacked for them or against them, but they just want someone to listen. What's the process? Give me a sense of what the process is like.
Well, yeah, my predecessor was famous for saying, you know, people complain that it's the process that we have, the severe and oversight process we have, is like the fox watching the hen house, and who's watching the fox? And he'd say, we are. The Center for Dispute Settlement is watching the fox. Because our process is one that looks at the actions of the police officer and the civilian within whatever the situation is. And I know Frank's going to spend some time talking about what that is. But part of the problem is trust that Mayor Johnson talked about, that people don't trust the process that exists right now. Right now, it is the only process we have, and it's the best one we have because it's the only one. And we'd like people to trust it enough to use it. Not enough people file complaints if there are complaints that they have against police officers. If they want to file a compliment, we'll take that too. But to use the process that exists so that we can work in. And if there's aspects of it that don't work, then we need to bring that to City Council, which we have done and the community has done, to make those changes.
And Frank, the vast majority of police officers I've ever met, I am proud of, and I'm proud that they're on the streets working with us. And this isn't to say that someone files a complaint, they're going to win, or lack a better word, win or lose, but that it's going to be sort of adjudicated in their favor in any way. It's to say that there is a forum that will address it, right? It doesn't guarantee an outcome.
That's exactly right. And what we're there to do is to we're available to assist the person in crafting that complaint. If they don't want to go, they can file a complaint by going directly to Internal Affairs. That's the professional standards section at RPD. If they're a little intimidated by that, we can help them to craft that complaint. And then we can talk to them about the complaint process, the investigation process. But our role is to oversee that complaint. We have audit authority over all civilian complaints for RPD. It's to oversee that complaint for three things: to make sure that they get a fair, thorough, and a timely review. Okay, we tell people up front, we don't advocate for you, we don't advocate for the police officer, but we do advocate for fairness and thoroughness and timeliness in that investigation.
And Frank, how do they contact you?
They can just call our offices, 546-5110, and ask for me, or Cheryl Hayward is our community advocate who helps people file complaints when they choose to do that. It's interesting that what we find is... we field a lot of calls for complaints, and oftentimes, and I would say at least two-thirds of the time, people need to vent that, and they need to express their frustration at an incident that occurred for them. But they failed to follow through on filing that formal complaint. We encourage them, you know, we don't go out and solicit complaints against police, but we encourage people, if you feel you've been mistreated by a police officer, I have to say to you, you have to follow through on that. Otherwise, you're tacitly condoning that behavior, you know, and allowing that officer, if you believe that that officer acted inappropriately, to continue to do that. So we encourage people to do that. But about two-thirds of the time, there's just a cathartic value to saying, expressing their concern to other folks, and they don't follow through. A little frustrating, because the question that occurs to me, do people feel so disenfranchised that they don't think they're going to get any satisfaction from that? So
yes. It's a good question. Bill, you're nodding right along here.
Yeah, and I want to say that, you know, I listened to a lot of complaints in my 12 years that people say, oh, this is not the perfect system. Well, it's a lot better than what exists in a lot of communities. And the fact that we have to realize is this: the New York State Legislature, New York State law does not permit civilian investigation of police. The police union is a very powerful union across the state. But we've had some breakthroughs, and I think Sherry and Frank will attest to the fact that the system that is currently being executed today is far different than the system that we started with, because it's been perfected along the way. The second thing that I think that people don't quite realize is this. They complain about the fact that there's a lot of information that is not provided, but there's a lot that is. And it doesn't, Sherry and Frank do not submit their reports to the mayor. The mayor gets a copy, but it goes to the city council. So that means you got nine. So I used to always tell people, you got 10 civilians who are involved in this process, okay? And in my time, and I'm sure that even now, I know Councilman McFadden is very outspoken on this issue, but in my time, we had council people who would not just sit there and look at this information. They would be probing. They would ask questions. They were trying to get to the bottom of it, and particularly in cases which rose to the level of controversy in the public eye. So I think that as a community, we're not perfect. But we certainly offer more redress than, say, maybe even Buffalo or Syracuse. I don't know if they've changed it, but I know that we've got some ability to impact the situation. And the only way a bad police officer gets away with his behavior is if nobody complains about it.
Let's get Jim in Rochester, who worries that it could happen here, what we're seeing in Ferguson. Go ahead, Jim.
This is a very interesting show because it has major implications not only in this community but throughout the country, as you said. But my basic question is, we had a situation in Arizona not too long ago in reference to the border situation with the small kids coming, young kids coming over the border from Mexico, from El Salvador, Guatemala, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a showdown between some citizens who basically took up arms, okay, and the Bureau of Tobacco, Firearms, and Alcohol. And let me tell you, this thing has major implications, because if those citizens in Ferguson would have taken that route, we could have had the potential of a major problem internally in the United States. And if our local government turns on the citizens of this country like they've done in a war scenario, Afghanistan, Iraq twice, that has profound implications for the future of this country. So we need to do some soul searching and understand precisely what's at stake so we can help turn this thing around.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Response from the panel here? Bill, do you disagree?
Well, no, I don't disagree, but I do think we have, I like to believe that it would never rise up to that level.
I think
the people who are apathetic, I think the people who are silent, the so-called silent majority, would rise up in arms if all of a sudden police officers were slaughtering people in the street. Look, we had this in the 60s. The Civil Rights Revolution is replete with examples of white police officers gunning down, mowing down innocent protesters in the streets. And this partly contributed to the turnaround of public approval for civil rights redress because of police overreaction. The Bull Connors, there could be no Bull Connor in this society today.
And this is not a perfect parallel, but look what happened in Kiev in February. When they started shooting indiscriminately protesters in Kiev, that's when things really changed. That's when the revolution happened in Kiev. That's a different country, but it's the same kind of mentality that when demonstrators are fired upon, it does not turn out well for the people shooting. And you have to hope that it wouldn't go that way. I want to ask the panel briefly about a couple comments that sort of line up here. First of all, A listener called to say that this is not a real police problem, it's a social problem. And on Twitter, Jake says the basic lesson is that people are angry. The real issues are getting lost in the conversation. These events would never happen if there weren't cultural tensions, period. From a practical standpoint, that is the root cause, and we're wasting too much time talking about policing issues. Let's go around the room here.
I would have to agree. I think this issue, first of all, the issue of race in America has never been fully dialogued on. Whenever I bring up race in different circles, it's never the appropriate time. Because this country has a...
Yeah, this is not a good time to talk about something.
Yeah, it's not. But
some other month, some other day.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. And so people keep pushing it under a rug. You know, if you have a rug and you keep pushing trash underneath a rug, it turns into a mountain. And that's what we have in America. And for me, being an intellectual, being a filmmaker, being a resident of the city, I'm at a point now where it's almost pitiful for us to be still talking about stuff of race. Police officers who work in our community need to know our community, need to know culturally, socially, the dynamics of the people that you're serving. Same with me as an educator. I can't go to Pittsburgh Sutherland pulling out Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey and Priest Lumumba books on the population at Pittsburgh Sutherland. I have to come into that school from a cultural standpoint to uplift the kids in that particular community. So if you're a police officer working in an urban environment, you should know the texture, cultural byways and more ways of that particular community so you can better serve them and we can trust you. If you are an invader, in most cases, if you come from outside of the city and you have no cultural sensitivity to the people you're serving, yeah, I'm going to shoot you in the face and I'm going to shoot you again. And then also the justice system. Is justice going to be served if that officer is brought to law? How many judges actually persecuted and fired and imprisoned police officers? Yeah. What's the stat on that? The Rodney King case was absurd. The Trayvon Martin case was absurd. The Jordan Davis case was absurd. Somehow the system sees it that, okay, people get a pass when you kill a black person.
Well, so. And if you missed it on this program on Thursday, there's a bit of a breakthrough here. You now have Congressman Paul Ryan agreeing that we over-incarcerate people in this country. We not only have too many people in prison, their sentences are too long, especially for nonviolent crimes, and that exacerbates inequality. You got Paul Ryan saying that.
You got the wrong Paul.
No.
It was
not
Rand Paul.
No. Paul Ryan.
Really?
Yes. In his new anti-poverty plan, because okay. Rand Paul and Ron Paul have been saying that for years. Yeah. Paul Ryan, essentially, in his new anti-poverty plan, does give room to the notion that we need to reform sentencing in this country and reform the way people are incarcerated because that exacerbates inequality. It's one small step, but if Paul Ryan is going to agree with that, we may actually see some movement on that angle. Bill, do you agree with Jake and Bernard's point that we're focusing too much on police work and that the larger issues are cultural, racial, et cetera, and we need to hit those first?
Well, there's an irony about those comments. The only time we even talk about race is when the police go awry. That's the real irony, because you're absolutely right. Nobody wants to talk about race. I've been in this field for almost 50 years. Don't make me uncomfortable. We're beyond that. You know, we got a black president. We live in a post-racial society. I don't want to talk about that anymore. Don't hold me responsible for the sins of my grandfather. All this kind of stuff. This is not 1900. This is 2014, and we still have these issues. So I think they happen to be intertwined. I think you can deal. You know, unfortunately, that's the way the package comes. You've got to unravel the racial issue before we can really begin to deal with the broader problem. Because I agree, we should not be talking. I should not, sitting here, somebody who lived during the civil rights eras in the 1950s and 60s, and 72 years old, should not be talking about this issue today. We should have solved this issue many, many decades ago. And we haven't.
Sherry and Frank, brief points before we get to a short break?
Yeah, I don't think we're talking too much about police because I think they're connected. And also, I go back to the other caller who was saying, you know, could this sort of happen, the violence with police against civilians, could it happen here? I think the fact that people fear that it could happen says a lot. In terms of where people are, people need to be angry still because we're still having these conversations about race and racism, and it's alive and well. I heard on the previous hour, the militarization of our police. I mean, all of that makes people fearful of what the police might be able to do. And if you're a black male or female or whatever, you have that fear greater from law enforcement than you do from the majority of community.
Frank?
In the cultural tension that goes on, I have to say I'm somewhat encouraged about Rochester over the last couple of years because of the Facing Race, Embracing Equity movement, the racial dialogues that have been going on through the library. They were mentioned on the previous hour, the DNC's Unite program. I mean, those are conversations that have been actually going on, talking about those difficult conversations for people to have. Our agency recently did a series of we showed the film July 64 in each of the quadrants of the city at one of the settlement houses, right in the areas where people were most affected by that. And there were conversations with law enforcement. We're big believers in our agency because we deal with conflict all the time. That conflict is not something to be avoided all the time, but actually can be a stepping stone for people to grow. So we embrace those kinds of difficult conversations. And I think maybe had we done this 50 years ago, we would have been a different place. But I have to say I'm somewhat encouraged in Rochester that there are groups of people that are really embracing those dialogues, as difficult as they may be.
Jane, Bonnie, Pat, you're next. Short break, and we're coming back on Connections here. We're talking about what's going on in Ferguson and parallels in our own community. Bill Johnson's here, former Rochester mayor and owner of a consulting firm called Strategic Community Intervention. Sherry Walker-Coart and Frank Liberti are here from the Center for Dispute Settlement, and Chewbacca Muasar is a filmmaker, made the film Young Black Male. Your calls on Connections are next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, are we over-policing parents in America? The author of a book called Free Range Kids says yes. Lenore Skenazy joins us to explain why we've criminalized parents for giving kids a little space. We'll also talk about the new online meme called I Don't Need Feminism Because, and its counterpoint, I Need Feminism Because. It's all Tuesday on Connections.
Last year's rim fire near Yosemite National Park left behind hundreds of thousands of acres of dead trees. Clearing them creates room for seedlings, but it also removes homes for wildlife.
The more severe a fire is, the better that area is going to be for blackback woodpeckers.
The dilemma over how to help a forest recover later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered tonight at 4 o'clock right here on WXXI and WEOS.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. This is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
I agree with the person that said that there's a great deal more than just a wrongful death that needs to be there before you have a riot. And I do want to remind people again, as I have a couple of times, that we are second in the nation in poverty for a town our size. And that, to me, is a disgrace. We have so much money in this town. And I would like to ask your panel if we could pressure the legislature and Governor Cuomo to give us a little bit of that $6 billion to shore up some of our problems here with crime and especially with poverty. Who would be willing to say what we should do first? Now, I know we've talked about voting that empowers people, but what would be on your priority list if you had a fair share of that money? Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. I think what she's referring to is a couple of recent settlements that one of them with a French bank, I think totaling anywhere from $3.5 to $6 billion that New York State will have discretion over. And so I'll ask the man who's been a lawmaker, Bill, is there a way to convince the state to invest more? I mean, I'm sure Mayor Lovely Warren is working on that. She's going to be on this program 48 hours from now. We can ask her about that. But what do you think, Bill?
I haven't had experience with dealing with the legislature for a number of years, but
I bet you don't miss it.
I will say this. I think that they, too, are in the active avoidance of dealing with these issues. I mean, it's easier to get the state to put money in a glistening new building on a waterfront and say, oh, by the way, it's going to create 500 jobs when the poverty level is a lot deeper than that. I don't know what it takes. You know, I'll say this. I was rather stunned to read that New York State had the most segregated schools in the nation. This report came out of the UCLA 3 or 4 months ago. I'm still waiting for Governor Cuomo and for the leaders of the legislature to even acknowledge that they govern a state that has the most segregated schools. Not Mississippi, not Georgia, not Louisiana, not Alabama, but New York State has the most segregated schools based on data tracking back to 1989. Now, if they can't even come out and express shame and remorse about that, how are we going to get them to divert money that they want to use for many other more visible and ends that will show quicker results? Poverty, working on poverty is going to take a long time to solve. Building a building on the Genesee River can be built in less than a year. And our politicians, unfortunately, opt for the former rather than the latter.
We've got a lot more calls to get through. This is Bonnie in Rochester. No, I just lost. What did I do to that phone? Mike, did I do that? I might have. Okay. Bonnie, I tried to go to Bonnie. That could have been the migraine. I apologize. Now let me see if I can figure this out here. I'm going to put this. Look at what have I done here? It's like this is my first day hosting the show. Pat from Rochester, is that you? Let's try Pat. Do we have Pat? We don't have Pat. Now I've lost Bonnie and Pat. That's great. Great work from your host there. Here, let me take a brief break and tell you that you can call the program, and let me check our online numbers is here as well. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and if I hang up on you, you can call back, and maybe we'll give you a discounted membership. Look at all the trouble I'm getting myself into. Let me get back now to Paul from Rochester, see if I can get Paul. Paul, is that you?
Yes.
You got a question about statistics. Go
I
ahead,
just,
Paul.
The statistics that you have for the city in Missouri as compared to Rochester, the Rochester Police Department as compared to the police department down there.
Okay, yeah, and Paul, hold on for a sec. I think what you're referring to is the fact that in Ferguson, I think 3 or 5 total officers are black out of 53 officers in Ferguson in a city that is 63% black. You're wondering what the ratio percentage is here in Rochester?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know offhand. Mayor, do you remember anything close to what it was here when you were serving?
Well, you know, we had a consent decree, and we've been trying to break 25% since 1979. And if we have broken it, we're right at it. 25% would be probably what number we're talking about in a community.
25% black police officers.
Or Latino. And in a city where blacks and Latinos account for over 55% of the population. So there is a disparity there. Not quite as bad as the one that is in Ferguson, but there's a disparity there as well.
Okay.
But they keep working at it. They have programs in place to keep working at it.
Bonnie, let's try it again. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. The first thing is, you know, even though you had talked earlier, the folks had talked earlier about the militarization of the police, it just seems to me that there's a kind of a standard, even without the extra uniforms and everything, that police have of using extremely aggressive overreaction to things that don't even come close to. No, there's no weapon involved. There's no, including the situation with Mr. Brown. This whole thing, and it's amazing because if you know anything about working with people in general when there's something's, you know, not going their way or there's some aggression, concerns, or problems, anxiety, the last thing you do is back people further into an aggressive act that they may feel, and that's not what happened in this situation, but, you know, that seems to be what the police do. They just seem to further accelerate. The second other thing, though, is that, you know, this has been mentioned, but I think it's so important, is that none of this is really going to ever get any better until we deal with the fundamental racism issues. You know, I make an analogy to this and the way you do about denial. You know, people, we all are human. We have denials about what we really don't want to look at because it's too uncomfortable or because we just, and I think the racism issue falls in that category. And, you know, the race and equity group has been meeting and coming up with recommendations, and they really want to be more, you know, action-oriented. So one of them is that if we could mandate that schools all through the school years in a more developmental fashion would deal with educating students who then become adults about racism, and in terms of the internal part of it, how you, you know, in your own mind, how that happens, the denial piece, the institutionalization of racism, the, you know, all these different parts of it that go deeper than just like diversity training. And then, and right now, not even the teachers have to have any of that kind of training. And it's really outrageous. And then you would be creating a potential path for the future where people could already have some basis for dialogue around the issues of racism. My third and last point is in response to Jane. Jane, we have an election coming up in November, where we have a Democratic primary and then an election in November for governor. I would suggest you go look at what these candidates stand for and look, try to look toward people who are providing more progressive alternative platforms, because they're there, they just don't get enough attention, and they have much better solutions. And like this governor doesn't want to raise taxes on the wealthy. So that's my little ending comment.
There you go. Thank you, Bonnie. Shabaka, she's talking about doing things that would plant seeds for a better dialogue on race. Would that help?
I think that would help. The racism issue is so pervasive that we need every organization, every government department, everybody in the country involved in this matter, because it touches every corner of America. As an African American living in America, I know that if you bring up the reason why race has not really been thoroughly investigated when it comes to the treatment of African Americans in this country, because then you have to talk about accountability. And then if you start talking about race and accountability, then you have to make some people accountable. And there's been a movement for years on reparations and making the wrongs right. That's documented, that there's some banks and insurance companies that had slaves and different people. So now you're going to have to start making people accountable. And then if you start looking at that dollar amount that's of accountability, then you're talking about an astronomical amount of money. And I think it's not in the interest of this government to bring up racism or even to do something about it, because it could be expensive. Not only, and it's uncomfortable. So I don't think that – I think what's more important for people who are disenfranchised is that we get together and we command a level of respect in our communities. So I think for us to try to combat and fix racism for everybody in America, I think at least we can fix it within ourselves and get ourselves together and unite. Because I think that it's people like Donald Sterling, it's like people like that that have so much money where they don't really – I'm not here to convince him that – I'm not a threat, or I'm not. I'm just it's the same person as you. I think we got to look at each other and see ourselves as that. And then maybe we'll get some people who could say, you know what, we kind of agree that, you know, young black males are, you know, we kind of see what you guys are going through. We're going to help you too. But the problem is so big and so pervasive that we can't do it all at once. But we can start in small pockets and work away from there.
2 points on that. He said the word reparations. Every time that happens, there are any certain percentage of people, usually white people, who kind of drive off the road and almost crash their cars when it comes to reparations. We talked about it on this program about 6 weeks ago. If you want to have a rational discussion about that on a separate occasion, start by reading the piece by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic. On the modern case for reparations. Totally different subject, but absolutely worth reading. Now, how about this? We just throw out third rail. No more third rail in American society. You want to talk about religion? We can talk about religion. You want to talk about politics? We can talk about it. You want to talk about race? We can talk about it. I think we raise kids to say, oh, you don't ever talk to somebody about religion or politics or race. It's like those are taboo things. Well, don't make them taboo anymore. All right?
Right. That's right, and things are better. I have some white friends and colleagues who, they just start, Shabaka, well, what do you think about that? And so I say, this is good. This is refreshing. People are feeling more comfortable to talk about race, because it's like when I had long dreadlocks at one time, and one of my friends said, wow, how's your hair lock up? It's that cultural ethnic separation that is so like elementary, and it's like it kind of made me giggle. Like, this is hilarious. Like, you should have dealt with this in fourth grade, in second grade. So I think it's always refreshing, always good, and it's okay to talk about race. It's okay to talk about difficult things, and like Frank said, talking about those difficult things can help spark some change.
Yeah. You don't want to bottle up a lot of the stuff that people have been dealing with. This is Kathy and Henrietta talking about segregation of schools. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. One of the points I wanted to make was that we still have such segregated schools that even if you expect police officers to be friendly with people in the city, the way to get people together is if they go to the same schools. And we're so segregated here in Monroe County that there are many white people who have in this county who have almost no contact with black people, and there's also black people in the city who have very little contact with white people except in very negative capacities. So city newspaper a few weeks ago talked about the countywide school district in Wake County, North Carolina, which successfully, they didn't stop segregation based on race, but on income level.
Kathy, can I jump in here, Kathy, real quick here?
Yes.
So we did an hour on that exact program on the show about 2 months ago.
And, oh, okay.
I couldn't agree more in terms of if you wanted to see what a model would look like. What they did in 1976, I believe, was they took the municipal school district, which was largely black and Latino, and they took the predominantly white suburban district, even though it was only two districts. It's not quite like Monroe County with 19. Two districts, and they merged them. And so only 40% of the school could be free and reduced lunch, 40%
right.
or less.
Right. I used to live down there, so my son went to those schools. And we went to a school that was in the inner city that was 40% low income, and there was a waiting list for that school and for most of the schools in the inner city. Because the county put extra resources into those schools.
Right.
So it'd be sort of like taking school number 9 downtown and just putting extra resources in it and lowering class sizes. And so you're turning it into a school that people from the suburbs can choose to go to.
Yeah, Kathy, thanks for the call. It's a very interesting point. We got about 90 seconds left here. And let me ask the man who... One of the reasons Bill Johnson lost by a lot of votes in the county executive race was, I think political historians will tell you there was a Pac-Man ad mm-hmm. that, I'm not saying you were proposing what Wake County did exactly, but when you talked about metro government, there is a fear factor that some people have in the suburbs that the diverse inner city is going to come eat you. And that's what the ad said, and I think that is partially why the margin of your campaign went the way it did.
Well, yes, and we can't relitigate that campaign.
And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, I'm just saying observation.
But let me say to the people like Kathy and my friend John Wilkinson and Mark Hare, who are salivating over the prospects of Wake County schools. The reason that is possible is because state law in North Carolina allows it. State law in North Carolina creates countywide school districts. State law in New York absolutely prohibits countywide school districts. So it goes back to a question somebody raised earlier. We really can continue to have these discussions. I can die and be born again. And we'll still be having these discussions until we go to the root causes. And we really do have to begin fighting to say, whatever the logic and reason for opposing these things 50 years ago, we need to reexamine them. Because right now, these are institutional barriers. We can't have anything resembling what's going on in Raleigh and Wake County and Durham until we change the laws in New York State that prohibit that kind of thing from happening.
Bill Johnson's consulting firm is called Strategic Community Intervention. Shabaka, where can people see Young Black Male? Can they find it?
Young Black Male will be available for DVD next month. We have hard copies of it, educational edition, and also you can have a digital download at youngblackmale.net.
Youngblackmale.net. And one more time, Sherry and Frank, the phone number for the Center for Dispute Resolution is?
Center for Dispute Settlement is 546-5110.
Thanks for taking the time to our panel today. 2 hours, not even enough on this subject, but at least I think, as Shabaka said, we're willing to talk about it, and we're not afraid to talk about it, no matter where that community conversation takes us. So our thanks to this panel and the one that preceded it, to all of your many calls and comments online. Couldn't even get to them all. And my thanks as well to our engineer, Mike Black, who is, I almost called him Mike Glass again, our engineer Mike Black. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections.